boots on bird watching, on charisma and charismatic species, which is my favourite from 2007. He's written on nematodes, he's written on moving animals and photography, and recently on Heck Cattle paper he's written with Clemens, and they're going to talk about some of that research. So it's Jamie Clemens Dressens, who's next to me. I'm a philosopher from the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands, who's been working for many years on the interactions of ethical philosophy, if you like, and animal, but particularly animal husbandry. And he was working with Jamie at King's College London on this project. Clemens has recently written a paper in the Journal of Agriculture and Environmental Ethics, which is a terrific paper, which is arguing for giving farmers perhaps a little bit more ethical room in their dealings with animals, which I think is a very interesting idea, given that we're in an increasingly regulatory universe. So there's some interesting stuff coming out of his sort of post-Heck cattle work, if I may say. So over to Jamie, who's going to introduce this joint project.
Great. Thanks, Henry. So, so as Henry says, we've got two papers that speak to each other but are quite different in their foci, and they come out of a project we've been doing about this idea of rewilding, which is emerging as a new paradigm for nature conservation, and it's playing out in different ways in different contexts. Particularly, there's a distinct kind of North American variety, and there's quite a different European variety of rewilding. This is a screen grab from the project website. There's a lot more information up there, so please have a look, and we'll make papers available on the site as they come together. The main empirical focus for the project has been one particular species, or one particular breed of cattle, the Heck cattle. This is a photograph of a Heck cow from the Oostvaardersplassen in the Netherlands, which was nicely set up yesterday. And the project looks both at historic efforts to create these animals by the brothers Heck to German zoologists, and then the way in which the cows have re-emerged as tools for rewilding across Europe. So Clemens is going to give the first paper, we're reversing the order, which is looking at some of the historical dimensions to cattle backbreeding programs in Germany at the start of the 20th century. And then I'll give a second paper, which is more about the kind of contemporary use of these cows as tools for naturalistic grazing and what that tells us about wildness in the present. So there's, in some ways, there's different understandings of wildness, different strands of wildness that run through these different historical moments that we want to tease out. Over to
Clemens. Yeah, thank you. Before I start, maybe I have two caveats. I feel a bit like the amateur historian going straight for the spectacular Nazi story. I'm somewhat of a philosopher, maybe SDS, but I'm not a historian. I went straight for the obviously fascinating tale. So I'm sorry about that. And the other thing is that researching this project and also telling about it is a weird combination of the hilarious and the horrific. So I'm really sorry if I you know, I'm weirdly laughing at moments which are inappropriate or not. I mean, sort of it's just a too weird subject actually. So. I hope to not offend or whatever. If I do, please, sorry. So this is how we started out. This is Derek Gow. He's a conservationist. He lives in Devon on a farm, and he brought in Nazi cows after 2,000 years. I don't know whether there were Nazi cows before Jesus, but anyway. So this was quite a big thing in the British press, and there's something about Britain and I wouldn't say obsession, but you do have a liking for things Nazi and houses that look like Nazi or like Hitler or whatever. So the supercars came over to Devon, led to this amazing concert. And you see, they were quite sort of, imagine there's a kind of occupational force of, you know, entering a territory and occupying it. And of course, for the British experience, that is quite a ridiculous notion. But we'll see that there's this whole. My talk is not just about corroborating the headlines of the British tabloid press. It's there's actually more to it, and I hope you'll find out. So this was 3 years ago. This is. Mentioned a few times, this is the Oostvaardersplassen area in the Netherlands, and there they are, the Heck cattle. You can see they look kind of primordial, but they also look a bit, not very purebred. So there's sort of sometimes it pops up a sort of weird coloration or something. There's something going on with them, and one of the reasons that it's relevant to know actually what their genealogy is and how wild they are is whether they can actually stand winter and how hardy are they, how wild, should we care for them or not. So in that sense, the genealogy is important. And the other way the genealogy is important is whether they are Nazi or not, which matters a lot to the people in Eastern Europe, where they want to roll out this grazing tool. These guys are performing ecosystem services there, as you see it, by grazing the land, keeping open the landscape, and bringing back nutrients to the soil. So they're sort of essential part of the ecosystem. These are the brothers Heck with their father. This is Ludwig Heck. He became the zoo director of the Berlin Zoo in 1888. And he turned that into one of the more prominent zoos at the time. And his two sons, they developed a kind of zoo director dynasty. So this is his eldest son, Lutz. So remember the names, we've come back to it a lot. This is Lutz, the eldest son. He was the zoo director. He became the successor of his father in becoming the zoo director of the Berlin Zoo somewhere in the 1930s. And this is Heinz, the younger brother. And he went out to Munich to become the zoo director of Munich. And he developed the concept of the geographical zoo, so to arrange the animals in a sort of in their geographical territories and in continents. So they were ambitious people. They were quite prominent people in Germany, and they would, yeah. Let me tell you first a little bit before I start about talking about the cows. What kind of context was at the time in zoology? There was two things. One of it was there was a fascination, I think, started at the end of the 19th century, sort of trying to find a sort of research program after understanding Darwinism. The idea was if you could create a liger or a tigron, sort of these hybrid figures, that somehow you were undoing evolution, or you were studying sort of evolution in a sort of reverse order, and because the idea was that they would have a common ancestor. So that was going on. People were interested in whether animals could be mated or not, and whether their offspring was fertile. Another thing is that in the 1920s, the European bison or wisent had gone almost extinct. So there were only a few of them left, most of them in sort of zoo collections or otherwise spread out. And this I think this was one of the first animals that was the subject of conservation efforts in terms of creating a herd book with all the animals known at the time to still exist. And with that, sort of a sense or an ideal of purity of wild animals emerged. While it didn't really matter whether it was actually quite a tame wild animal, but it was more a matter of having the sort of genetic purity and then the sort of aesthetic purity some of the more or less hybrid wisent looking animals were said, no, these are not true proper wisents. So this is not the primordial cow. And there's often the confusion, especially at the time, that there's a lot of confusion that this might be the primordial cow and then our current domestic livestock descended from it. No, this was a separate species. And that was one of the reasons why the Heck brothers decided to see whether they could recreate this one. And this is actually one of these cave paintings are actually one of the considered to be the sort of one of the most adequate representations of this animal. The primordial cow went extinct in 1627 when the final cow languished in a Polish forest. But of course, we still have all those sort of domestic breeds running around. So the idea of the Heck brothers was, at the time, to try to recreate this particular animal. And they had sort of they started more or less together, but on their separate zoos. And so they had a different ideas of where to go. So Lutz Heck, the Berlin brother, he traveled throughout Europe, trying to look for interesting cow species or cow breeds. Sorry, not species. Interesting cow breeds. So for instance, he went to Corsica, where you have this semi-wild cow, and especially this one has the right horn shape. As you can tell from this. So this was the template. Horn shape, Corsica, south of France, you got the right coloration, sort of the dark complexion. And then, of course, you need a fierce animal. So he went to Spain and bought some bullfighting bulls. And then in the 1930s, they claimed success. They recreated the aurochs as Julian Huxley. He went out there, met them, and he termed them the synthetic aurochs. So the aurochs is the primordial cow. And they're here, grazing in their zoo exhibit. And so they mentioned the aurochs, newly bred from primitive cattle breeds. So the question is, are these Nazi cows? How come these are Nazi cows? The brothers started their breeding efforts in the 1920s already, so that's predating Hitler, not Hitler himself, but his coming to power. And then, for one thing, it's interesting to have a look at, this is Ludwig, the father of the two brothers, in his autobiography. And he mentions, just quickly read, "The outstanding Führer, together with his outstanding helpers, have lifted the stone from my heart when he based our state as the first in the world fully on natural scientific foundations, on blood and soil, and thereby on natural ground." So it's this interesting mixture of mangle of natural science, mythology, blood and soil, which all sort of, in the minds of this person, is a sort of logical unity. And it speaks for his complete inner inborn essence. Finally, in Nazi Germany, politics and worldview are no longer unbridgeable things. Now we are realizing our ideas, our national German, racial German worldview through our national socialist politics. And he proudly recalls that one of his sons said, "Father, you were a national socialist even before the term was invented." So in that sense, with this father, you could say that while they were, started their work in the 1920s, that there might have been this ideology around them. And this is part of the context at the time, at the late 1930s. It is an infamous drawing by Konrad Lorenz, who would later go to win the Nobel Prize for his work in ethology. And he is clearly idealizes the wildness as opposed to the urban, as opposed to the sort of decadent, and both for humans and for animals. So you see the wild shape of the wolf, and here the dog, sort of the, well, you see the same process happening in humans. And of course, you know, it's pretty clear where the allegiance of Lorenz was. And what he did was he sent a letter to his mentor, Oscar Heinroth, which was the head of the aquarium of the Berlin Zoo. So he was there with the Lutz Heck brother. And he asked Heinroth to send him pictures of animals to sort of present this to in public presentations. And what Heinroth did, he sent in a number of pictures of these animals, and he included the aurochs that was bred here. So that was, in that sense, it fed into this fantasy or this ideal of wildness as opposed to domestication, as opposed to urban life, as degeneration. Another thing is the infamous book on sort of the major eugenics tome. One of the authors was actually in the board of the Zoo of Berlin, and Lutz says that both of the authors that were alive at the end of the 30s were enthusiastic about this project of undoing domestication by breeding. I'm going to speed up a little bit. Let me say that Lutz Heck had this amazing career, not only as a zoo director, but also in the Nazi authorities. Very early on, he became very good friends with Goering. They shared an interest in hunting, and he would go to their family homes and drop off lion cubs. He was made an honorary professor on the birthday of Hitler. In 1938, he became the head of the nature conservation area of the Forest Authority. And this is him. This is Lutz Heck, together with Hermann Goering, on a hunting trip, and they were carrying spears. And that is significant as why was this going so interested in this? This is the Nibelungen Lied, a small section of the Nibelungen Lied. It's this founding myth of the Germanic people, and it's also known from Wagner. It's about Siegfried, a knight, and Siegfried was famous for his hunting abilities. And at one point in the Nibelungen Lied, Siegfried killed a number of animals. So he killed a bison, an elk, aurochs, deer. So basically, what you could say that Göring wanted is he wanted to complete this Teutonic ecosystem, to perform the Teutonic leadership sort of role and hunting those animals. For that reason, he had a keen interest in having this aurochs as well. Otherwise, the whole hunting experience wouldn't be complete. This was a fantasy of wildness and wild cows. Here, Göring with his spear. A photo made by Lutz Heck. Interestingly enough, they enjoy themselves in this way. And part of it, there's also, I'm going to go very shortly on this, there's also a geopolitical angle to it. There was a sense that the eastern land needed to be restored in a way, because the racial inhabitants of that area were not treating the land well. There was no tree left, clearly a sign of degenerate living on a land. This is really weird travel guide of the occupied Polish territories, saying that the landscape is quite horrible, horribly treated. I'm going to skip it. So Lutz Heck was part of an effort in which the idea was that the conquering the eastern land was not just great Lebensraum for people, but also to restore the landscape that was sort of robbed from its cultural character. So it's not an opposition of culture and wildness, but there's a sense of culture that is beneficial to nature. So this is deforestation, and then these are plans for reforestation of the eastern lands to prevent climate change, actually. And Lutz Heck was quite central in. This is right after the takeover of the right after the occupation of Poland. So in, I think this was, when was this? Anyway, at that time, and Lutz published in the Völkische Beobachter, which is the official Nazi newspaper. He published a sort of programmatic piece on national parks for Greater Germany, which included the newly conquered areas. There's this idea of ecological restoration that now could be taken up. These Auroxes were put out in Romintenheide, which is in eastern Prussia, and then they wreaked havoc there with the deer feeding, so that sort of disrupted the hunting process. So they were brought even further to the Białowieża wilderness, which is now on the Polish Russian border, to roam there free. In a way, when you read these texts, it's almost as if the entire conquering of the Eastern Europe was to promote sort of the expansion of the non-human Lebensraum of find room space for cattle to graze. There was a propaganda film made over these animals the Romintenheide area, and at some point they had to stop filming because the guns in the distance were getting too loud, and so it's really this weird motives behind this whole thing. Then because these animals were there, the what they call the poachers, the bandits that were still roaming around in this forest. They could be shot at plain sight by the foresters there. So this is 1943 in Białowieża, so near the current Russian border. This is Lutz Heck there's the head Jägermeister of the area, and they're just, you know, sort of spending the winter there hunting. And when the Soviets come over, Göring personally shot the Oroxen that were left there in order to prevent them from falling into enemy hands. So they had this sort of the backbred Oroks, in a way they come out of this story, is that they're this odd combination of the Völkisch mythical sense of the Nibelungenlied, the connection to the soil. There's the racial element of eugenics, there's the spatial one of rewilding this geopolitical area, and there's this sense of biological purity that can be found in these domestic species. On the other hand, you may have noticed that I've mostly spoken about Lutz Heck, while his brother Heinz was in Munich, and I found that he was quite a different character. For one thing, there are some reports that say that he was actually put in a concentration camp in 1933 for being a member of a communist party or something. It's very unclear whether that was true. But in any case, he was the only zoo director in Germany who was not a member of the Nazi party. There were Gestapo files on him that he had a non-Aryan wife. And at one point, Rudolf Hess gave the Munich Zoo a lion and he shot it for apparently no reason. So very, resistance-like deed. So, in terms of when Heinz describes these animals, it's not in terms of Germanic myth, but in terms of a greater European past. There were no geopolitical desires involved in his discourse. He's not praising Nazi authorities, and there's no human eugenics linkages or anything. And he had used different animals, so he didn't use the fighting breeds or anything. He had Highland cattle, Hungarian steppe cattle, and he used to save time. I bought some crosses, so it's sort of really funny a way of breeding. And those are actually, we went to the Devon farm that we started with. And so these are the you can clearly see the difference between these sort of ordinary cattle breeds who are peacefully grazing and these hack cattle who are sort of alertly looking at what we are doing. So this, in that sense, they're still wild. This farmer is trying to, or this conservationist, he's trying to, in a way, tame them. But these cattle, and these are the cattle that are in the Oostvaardersplassen, are the descendants of the Heinz line, so in that sense, that would sort of set them free of the accusation of being Nazi cattle. They're actually sort of cosmopolitan resistance army. At least that was the story that we really clung to, until we found out that there might have been a few Lutzian Berlin bulls that were mixed into the herd. So there's no ideological purity, and I guess that's even better in a way. That's my bit.
Thank you very much, Clement.
Okay, so I want to pick up the story in the contemporary situation and think about what this backstory tells us about how we think about wildness in the Anthropocene. So many of you will be familiar with this idea of the Anthropocene, a kind of enthusiasm amongst geologists that we've entered a new era in which we might understand humans as a geological force. And the diagnosis of the Anthropocene creates this kind of paradox for people thinking about wilderness. There's this sort of much diagnosed people like Latour and Bill Cronin have talked about this, a sense that, you know, in this kind of modern juncture, nature is understood as this sort of single authentic thing removed from society. But it's only revealed to us by modern natural science and can only be restored and conserved by modern engineering, markets, bureaucracy, etc., etc. There's this sort of paradoxical form of critique that seems to come out that, you know, you reveal the made status of wildness in order to debunk claims towards wilderness. And for us, in terms of making sense, some of the materials I want to talk about in a second, this doesn't get us very far. You know, once you've kind of unmasked the made status of wildness, where does it leave you? Particularly in the Anthropocene, when there's a sense that the planet, to a certain extent, has become, you know, fundamentally entangled with human activities, and many people would say has always been fundamentally entangled with human activities, but there's this kind of public diagnosis now that, you know, that idea of a nature removed from society is no longer that useful for guiding conservation. So people like Latour and Ulrich Beck have talked about how the diagnosis of the Anthropocene, a particular awareness that, you know, nature is not a stable thing that remained consistent through time but adheres to a kind of non-linear, non-equilibrium set of dynamics, poses all sorts of challenges to those charged with environmental governance for coming up with ways of, you know, managing wildness, let's say, and particularly a sense that the laboratory has taken over the world, to use Latour's terminology, that it's no longer possible to think about science happening in a context removed from society, but you know, the consequences of our experiments on the environment have spilled over to the extent that everybody needs to be involved in deliberating as to how science is conducted in the Anthropocene. So in a way, this sets up an interesting backdrop for thinking about wildness, thinking about how we imagine wildness, how wildness is governed, and different models that are emerging from both this past tracing, where we have one kind of fairly autocratic quest for the authentic, a sort of single notion of a kind of feudalist idea of harmony between men clad in leather and sort of wild animals, versus what I hope to trace out is happening in the Dutch context, a much more open-ended, in some ways much more cosmopolitan, to use Latour's terms, a kind of multinational set of deliberations where there are multiple trajectories in which wildness could take place, and we need to think about the kind of tools in which we would use to critically interpret the way that wildness is governed in the context of nature conservation. So what I want to briefly do is to look at least two, and maybe three if I have enough time, dimensions around which we might critically look at how wildness is being presented in the Anthropocene. So questions of found and made, a kind of ontological set of questions about, you know, what do we think wildness is, and how does that legitimate certain types of experiments that can take place in the field? And then a set of questions more geared around questions of transcendence and immanence. What do we think the dynamics of natural systems are? How do we make decisions in circumstances of uncertainty, where you're not really sure what an ecology will do, particularly under conditions of accelerated climate change, let's say, where you can't appeal to some timeless baseline, where in some ways you want to nurture surprises. And then a set of political questions about, you know, who gets to decide. Michel Calon, French sociologist of science, has a very nice idea of research taking place in the wild, and that's not really the kind of wild that we think about. It's a sort of wild in which processes open to deliberation, and he differentiates between secluded research and research in the wild. And if I get time, I'll talk a little bit about the way that he uses wildness as a kind of political epistemological construct for thinking about the place of science in society. Okay, so just to pick up the story again, this place, Oostvaardersplassen, which has been mentioned quite a lot, is a polder just north of Amsterdam in the Netherlands, which was originally created as part of, you know, a huge scheme of land reclamation in the Netherlands in the 1960s, but was never developed for industry. It was kind of abandoned. It's a swampy site, and it was gradually colonized by geese, and all sorts of interesting ecological things started to happen. You had various sort of forms of ecological succession happening, lots of sort of surprising ecological developments. It was taken over by Staatsbosbeheer, which is the Dutch Nature Conservation Organization, particularly through the work of a guy called Frans Vera, who's a Dutch ecologist, but also a bureaucrat who's sort of been charged with managing this site. And in the 1980s, Frans Vera had heard about these het cattle, and he set off into Germany to try and get hold of these animals, which had developed this reputation of being very hardy beasts that could survive the winter. Vera was looking for a surrogate that could replace the aurochs and the tarpan, these sort of antecedent grazers that would have been so important for driving the ecology, he argued, of Western Europe. So he'd heard about these aurochs, and he set off and he bought various specimens from across Eastern Europe, and he got Koenig ponies, and he stuck them into this nature reserve. And the premise was that you just kind of let them go. You know, they would de-domesticate themselves, they would return to some kind of grazing dynamics, they would breed as they saw fit, and they would die when there was a shortage of food. And this would, for him, prove his hypothesis that the climax vegetation community of Western Europe wasn't the high forest, which is so central to kind of Nazi imaginations of what Europe was, but a shifting mosaic of forest pasture landscapes. So he's sort of coming up with quite a revolutionary understanding of what the paleoecology of Europe would have been, which would then inform conservation practice in the future. So it's not about, you know, keeping the big grazers out of the forest, because the forest is the transcendent archetype, but actually the grazers would have been key drivers of the ecology of Europe, and we need to instigate those processes in order that you might restore various dynamics. Okay. So what I want to do is to look at some of these experiments that they've been doing at the Oostvaardersplassen, and to see what they tell us about how wildness figures in Holland, and by extension other areas of Europe where this model is gradually being scaled up as a way of thinking about conservation in the context of land abandonment and climate change, particularly in sort of marginal areas of Eastern Europe. So this is a big table, I apologise for it, but in which you can get a bit of a sense of what the kind of biopolitics of wilding is about. So the five columns sketch out five different modes of biopolitics associated with how we manage cows. So biopolitics about the management of life, agriculture, conservation, welfare, biosecurity, all of which can be differentiated from wilding according to the categories on the rows on the left-hand side. I'm particularly interested here in the differences between wilding and conservation and wilding and animal welfare. So the first theme I want to explore relates to questions about whether we understand this site and the animals that are on it as found or made. You know. So on the one hand, Franz Bierer presents the Ostwaldesplatzen as an ideal laboratory to test his scientific hypothesis, this hypothesis that the paleoecology of Western Europe was the shifting mosaic of forest pasture landscapes. This land was literally made. It was, you know, dragged out of the sea. Without the dikes and the pumping, it would be back under the sea again. It is, in many cases, it's a laboratory. It's a site that you can control the variables on it. You know, there's a site in which you can manipulate, you can run an experiment in that way. But of course, the legitimacy of the experiment and the findings of it rests on the fact that this will be taken as a surrogate for the authentic. You know, this needs to be taken as, you know, what Western Europe would have been like in prehistorical times. So you need to be able to kind of downplay the human interventions to show that this is, you know, self-willed land that is taking its trajectory according to the activities of the grazers. So, of course, many people who are critical of OVP and the claims made on the basis of it like to point to this paradox. You know, the findings that you're getting are only because you can, you know, keep the water out, because you kept the animals in through fencing. It's very much about, you know, this idea that this is inauthentic. It's not a kind of a true recreation of what Pleistocene Europe would have been like. However, Franzer is very, you know, keen to present his idea not as a sort of hypothesis that would be tested in a kind of positivist sense of disputing the hypothesis, but more as a kind of an open-ended notion of an experiment where you've got a set of, you know, possible parameters around which you might anticipate certain trajectories to emerge, but not in a way that, you know, you could necessarily have a clear set of criteria around which you would know that this was, you know, the ideal paleoecology. So he's quite happy in a way to forsake the kind of epistemic power of the pristine wilderness. If he was studying Yellowstone, he'd have a different set of criteria. And if he was, you know, running a model farm, he'd have a very different set of criteria. It's a sort of a fudge between the two, where he sort of shuttles between the truth that's afforded people who work in the field and the truth that's afforded people who work in the laboratory. It's a very uneasy shift. Of course, the Dutch public, they have a very different set of concerns about these animals. You know, they're not so concerned about experimenting with a made landscape. They're much more concerned about the treatment of the cattle and horses that have been introduced to drive this experiment. So these animals were not found in the wild. They didn't arrive of their own accord. They were taken from zoos. They were once, you know, pretty much domesticated. Many of the animals had kind of languished in, you know, semi-domestic circumstances after the war. And they're confined within a fairly small reserve. It's sort of 6,000 hectares. So for important constituencies, these animals are not wild, they're fundamentally kept. You know, they are, you know, they're animals that should be subject to the forms of care and concern that you would associate with animals under forms of animal experimentation. So there's a whole different kind of logic of animal experimentation associated with kept animals to animals that we might find in the wild. So, you know, if the animals had got there of their own accord, like the deer in the neighbouring forest of the Veluwe, they're not subject to the same forms of ethical protocol as these animals that had, you know, for better or worse, been introduced into the reserve. There are animals that have got into the reserve of their own accord, which are not subject to the same ethical protocol. So there's this kind of historical, you know, genealogy that's really significant in configuring forms of concern. So the Dutch conservation authorities have gone to great lengths to have these animals classified as wild, and there was a complicated court case in which they absolved themselves of property rights, so that they were no longer legally responsible for these animals. But it had the potential to be an enormous public relations disaster. This is a very visible site. It's in the suburbs of Amsterdam, pretty much. People, there's a train line that goes through it. Everybody can see it. So they had to come up with a sort of compromise, a kind of fudge that could shuttle between the lab and the field and the ethical protocols associated with different forms of wildness in these spaces. So there's this poor guy, the wildlife ranger, who has to keep the population under control. So the major issue is that they run out of food. So it's a bounded nature reserve. You've got, you know, a fast-growing population of large herbivores, and they starve to death. And it's very visible, and it's, you know, it's not a nice thing to look at if you're working under the assumption that these aren't wild animals in the sense of, you know, what you would find in the Serengeti, let's say. Although they try and present this as Serengeti behind the dikes, it hasn't really taken hold, that imagination. So this poor chap has to do what's called a predator simulation model. So he has to decide, with the eye of the wolf, which animals would or wouldn't survive the winter, and then dispatch them clinically with a rifle. So there's this sort of wonderful, you know, kind of shuffling between these two dimensions, very clinical model of population control performed by somebody who, I mean, Clemens, you spent a lot of time with him and maybe probably putting slightly words into his mouth, but there is this sense that he has to imagine, you know, what it would be like to be a predator sizing up a population of animals. But we don't know that much about wolf predation regimes and how wolves would size up the quality of a cow. We know a lot about how animal welfarists size up the quality of the cow because it's, you know, it's legally encoded. So in many ways, those are the criteria that are used, mapped onto a wolf, to decide which cows would or wouldn't survive the winter. It's a wonderful kind of interplay between different regimes accorded different spaces, which depend a lot on whether or not we understand these as found or made animals. And that, you know, in some ways opens up really interesting questions about wildness in this circumstance, where they're not appealing to some pristine, they're not appealing to the past, and they can't get away, and I think Vera would probably like to get away a bit more with absolving himself of responsibility. There's this kind of very modern form of biopolitics associated with various forms of science and various forms of technology that are mapped onto to these animals. I'm conscious that we're getting pretty close to 5 minutes. Okay. So that's one, I mean, really interesting dimension we can explore about the found-made, the way in which these things are governed. The second dimension that we could talk about briefly is about order and surprise, and this touches quite a lot on tensions between wilding as a model of conservation and orthodox models of conservation, which, at least in Europe, have been critiqued a lot for adhering to a fixed model of the present. Steve Hinchcliffe talks about conservation being obsessed with rendering the present eternal. You know, we know exactly what we want and we're trying to keep it in place, very much concerned with composition. You know, we know the existing composition of particular landscapes and, you know, for better or worse, in order to resist the depredations of modern agriculture, we need to hold fast to the present. But actually, conservation is fine, but that drains a lot of, you know, what's interesting about ecological systems out of the mix, because, you know, what matters to a certain extent is the processes rather than the composition. And some of what's happening in rewilding, some varieties of it are much more geared around releasing processes rather than, you know, holding on to composition. You know, we heard about, you know, the potential reintroduction of the cheetah in parts of the US, and obviously the cheetah is a charismatic animal, but they want the cheetah because of what it would do to the grazing dynamics of the pronghorn deer, let's say. There's an idea that, you know, you can instigate a process that would have interesting, you know, evolutionary ecological effects. Of course, in Europe, conservation is legally encoded in a very, very strict fashion. You know, we have all sorts of territories, we have all sorts of lists, we have all sorts of taxonomies, and conservationists' hands are strongly tied by that. That's where the funding comes from, that's where there's a huge amount of invested interest in protecting particular ideas about what nature is. This is a mess. OVP is a mess. You go there and, you know, it's all sorts of, you know, kind of animals dying around the place. Nobody quite knows what's happening. There's no action plan. There's no targets. There's no monitoring. You know, conservationists are up in arms. They fear that this is damaging their hard-fought idea of, you know, a particular baseline that they can manage towards. And so a lot of pressure is applied on them to count birds. And, of course, in Europe, we're obsessed with birds. And birds suffer quite a lot when you've got large grazers wandering around the place because they trample the nest and all the rest of it. But it has also thrown up some really interesting surprises. So for the first time in recorded memory, we have sea eagles who've come to this site because of the amount of dead meat nesting below sea level. So this is, I think, below sea level. That doesn't look at, you know, if the dikes were removed. So you've got these really surprising, anomalous ecological events that are happening in this site, particularly because they've kind of released it from the constraints of conservation. You know. So sea eagles, you wouldn't anticipate in a management plan. They talk about these sort of novel ecosystems that are emerging in this kind of very much Anthropocene context, in which you need very different management protocols in order both to anticipate and manage these emergent properties, which conservationists are quite poorly equipped to decide. So for me, there's some interesting kind of managerial governance dimensions to this, particularly because it's kind of tearing up the rule book around nature conservation, which has been invested a lot in particular ideas of kind of timeless archetypes, the balance of nature, linear succession, particular charismatic species. So there's interesting things going on there around this relationship between order and surprise. There's more things we have to say about ideas about deliberation. Vera has alienated pretty much everybody in the Netherlands. He's a very unpopular character. He's not a good place to start if you want to think about the public engagement sides of this. There's an ongoing contemporary project trying to kind of continue what the Heck brothers were doing, backbreeding these cows to create a Tauros cattle. So it's not an aurochs, and it's certainly not a het cattle. It's a kind of, it's a new breed of cattle that will be used in these rewilding projects, which in theory is informed by cutting-edge DNA technology, and there's a lot of, you know, investment in this. The DNA inevitably has proved rather inconclusive. Nobody quite knows, you know, what a wild cow should be. There's lots of forms of expertise associated with Project Tauros. We got really interested in the role of an artist who, Marlene Falius, who's a famous Dutch cattle painter, who's got really involved in this network and kind of mediates between these different forms of expertise and has enacted this quite interesting form of deliberation to try and bring the geneticists in line with the ethologists, with the anatomists, to come up with a particular idea about what the Tauros should be. And there's some interesting kind of political epistemological dimensions to that associated with how she creates these cows and the particular ways in which she negotiates with different forms of expertise. Haven't got time to say that. What I just want to conclude with is the kind of continued geopolitics of this. So Rewilding Europe is a big Dutch organisation, NGO, has a lot of money from the Dutch National Lottery equivalent, and they're sizing up Eastern Europe as the new frontier. This is where the wildland is. You know, you've got land abandonment, you've got lots of people leaving the lands, you've got lots of, you know, big beasts out there, and through a kind of network paradigm of conservation, we can tempt them back west. Because people living in the East are not enormously keen on this idea, and there's a lot of, you know, friction about this, and hence some of the histories of the Nazi, you know, cattle get invoked. But to their credit, they're much more willing to think about differentiating cattle by regional specificity. So there's talk of an Italian aurochs, you know, a Romanian aurochs, you know, which would have elements of the breeds of that area, which, you know, they can make an ecological case for because they have better adaptation to the climate, but also a kind of cultural sensitivity to the fact that you can have difference within a broader category of the cow, let's say, and a kind of perhaps a more cosmopolitan idea of what, you know, a wild cow could be and the way that it could play particular roles in certain settings. So the history persists, it's different, and obviously we have to be very careful with making any kind of comparisons between the past and the present, but these themes continue to circulate as Europe expands, and, you know, some of these territories continue to be debated about, you know, what kind of restoration should take place, who has authority to talk about these things, etc., etc. Okay, we'll stop there.